Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Within the backdrop of the Civil War and the assassination of President Lincoln was a major rivalry between two men who were ushering in a new chapter in journalism by using a new tool, photography. It was to that time what digital technology has been here in the last decade or so. Two giants stood out, Matthew Brady and Alexander Gardner. Brady gets a lot of credit for Gardner's work. Their story is well told in the latest book by former Post-Dispatch reporter Nick Pister. It's titled Shooting Lincoln, Matthew Brady, Alexander Gardner, and the Race to Photograph the Story of the Century. Nick is also the author of The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked a nation. It centers on an unsolved 19th-century murder in the Metro East. Nick and I sat down with a bookstore audience at Left Bank Books in the Central West End the other night. I asked him how and why he thought there was a book in the Brady Gardner story.
Well, you had mentioned my previous book, which is on an unsolved axe murder from the 19th century. And that was somewhat more challenging to write than this book, where there's a lot more information about President Lincoln and his assassination in that time. And the one thing that stood out to me, there were no pictures. They were really a poor German immigrant family, not too poor because they were allegedly killed over a gold fortune that they inherited. But people did not take pictures if they were not of a well-to-do society in that time period. Mm-hmm. So I had come across a photo of the hanging of the Lincoln conspirators, and there was a story about it that was written several years ago about it had gone to auction and sold for a lot of money. And I thought it was interesting that there was a story behind that story, because the article had talked about how the sequence of events that had taken place that time when the conspirators were hanged in July of 1865, shortly after Lincoln was assassinated, had really been the beginning of modern media that we have today. And I wanted to know who the guy was who took those photos and how all of this happened. And I went back and traced their steps, which really began before the Civil War, right through it, and it culminated in this epic moment when President Lincoln was shot and killed.
Most people, I think, who have looked at that era at all would recognize the name of Matthew Brady. He is associated with so much of the photography from the Civil War, but I never heard of Alexander Gardner, and yet his role was enormous.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think Alexander Gardner surpasses Matthew Brady. Yeah. Matthew Brady is perhaps the foremost photographer of the 19th century, one of the most famous photographers to ever exist. But his understudy, Alexander Gardner, who he had met in 1851 at the London Exhibition, had actually come over to the United States shortly after that. And he studied under Matthew Brady, who was the most famous photographer in this country. He was celebrated. He was one of the foremost pioneers in photography that we will ever have. And his understudy learned from him, but also advanced photography while Brady became this sort of mythic figure where he branded himself. It was always called Photo by Brady. And as the Civil War started, that created a rift between Brady and his understudy, Gardner. And between the beginning and the end of the war, Gardner broke away from him and ended up founding his own studio and ended up taking some of the more epic shots of the Civil War and ultimately most of the famous shots of the Lincoln assassination.
You mentioned that always labeled photos by Brady, even when they were photos by Gardner.
Yes, and that was part of the rift. Yeah. There was the famous Battle of Antietam, which occurred in 1862.
Battle of Bull Run.
No.
That wasn't?
Bull Run was the first battle of the Civil War, which Brady actually went to, and everyone, all the photographers were preparing for this war because it was going to be the first war that was ever photographed. And Brady was the one who actually went out onto the battlefield. They had all gone out there. They knew the Civil War was ready to happen, and they thought they were going to a Broadway show. Everybody was partying on the way out there, and Brady was lugging a big wagon full of glass plates to take the photos, which would be almost impossible if you think about it today in modern journalism when you just bring a big camera out, which is totally different. What ended up happening was Brady realized very quickly the bloody nature of war, and it scared him. He was almost killed in the battle. The soldiers did not care much for the media, and they weren't protecting their lives, much less anyone else, as we see today. Brady made it back from the Battle of Bull Run, and was such a good showman. His studio was actually in New York. He had a satellite studio in Washington, but Brady had learned from his neighbor, P.T. Barnum, on Broadway. Brady was called the Brady of Broadway, and P.T. Barnum was right next door. Brady learned that he could showcase himself as the big photographer of the country, and he put out all these photos of himself on his way back from the Battle of Bull Run. They took a picture of him in his studio, not on the battlefield, with his duster that he had worn, and it made it look like he had just come back from battle. He had had a sword attached to his hip and all of that. Brady actually did not return to the battlefield for many years after that. Gardner was the one who went out there, and in Antietam, he took the first photos of the real dead of the Civil War. Brady put them on display at his studio in New York in 1862, and it changed the way Americans view war. It was the first time they saw soldiers who were killed up close. And the New York Times had said that that was the moment where media had changed, where it wasn't just printed names in the paper, but it was actually somebody could go to his studio, like we have movie theaters almost today, and they could see what the faces looked like of the dead. Yeah. They said it was like bringing a hearse to your door.
Before we get into more of that, and I do want to talk about some of that, let's talk a little bit more about these two personalities. You mentioned P.T. Barnum, and my recollection from the book was that he really featured himself that way. He craved attention and found ways to capture it. What about his personality of that sort and Gardner's personality?
I think they were very polar opposites. Brady loved celebrities. He loved hanging out with celebrities. He loved the wealthy people of the time period. He made his name off of taking profile shots of the most famous men and women of the era. In 1851, when he went to the London Exhibition, he became internationally famous because he had displayed photos of the famous Americans, and there was a lot of interest in Europe of what Americans really looked like, and he had photos of Andrew Jackson, and he had photos of John C. Calhoun, and he had photos of all these rugged Americans that people had a lot of interest in Europe, and Brady loved to hang out with them. He loved to dine with them. He loved to be part of their world. Gardner was much different. He was a newspaper editor in Glasgow, Scotland, had come to the United States after he had met Brady, but he had a more documentary view of what photography should be. And the Civil War was obviously his big moment to shine, and boy, did he do it. And I don't think if Gardner didn't exist, I don't know if Brady would have been able to do what he did.
How long had photography been around by the time these two guys were going at it?
It was in its infancy. Brady was actually one of the pioneers of it. Brady, when he went over to the London Exhibition in 1851, he was going to meet Louis Daguerre, who was the guy who really invented photography. Daguerre had actually died while Brady was on the ship going over there. And so photography was only about 15 to 20 years old, but certainly not something people had adopted into their households or anything like that. The Civil War brought photography into the American household because it was the first time an American soldier would go to battle. And the only way that they would have any memory of them if they died, and 750,000 people died in that war, the only way that they would remember their brother, their father, would be if they had a picture of them. And so Brady and Gardner and many other photographers at that time made a lot of money during the run-up to the war because everybody was rushing to these studios to get photos of themselves.
Were there a lot of photographers around at that time?
Yeah, it became sort of a cottage industry, and every town had a photography shop that everybody would go to get their picture taken, especially if they were going to war. They would also display photos. Most of the photos displayed in the small towns across the country were photos that had been taken by Brady and some of them taken by Gardner.
But prior to the war, most of the work they did was just portraits.
It was mainly just portraits because to take a photo then you had a long exposure time, so you had to sit there very still. That's why you don't see them smiling, because if they were smiling it would look very weird because you can't hold a smile for 10 seconds. So that was what it was, and so that's what it became.
But then with the war and with the cumbersome nature of the field in those days, and I mean the photographic field, photography field, getting set up during battle had to be a tremendously difficult challenge.
Yes, and that's what Brady learned at Bull Run, that you couldn't just go out there and try to film a war as it was happening because you needed at least 10 seconds to be able to do that. So what we ended up getting in Antietam, which happened actually a couple years later, was the photos of the dead in the battlefield, the photos of the horses in the field, the photos of soldiers in piles of bodies and things like that. Right. That is really what the only photography that we were able to get, and we'll see the innovation with the Lincoln assassination later.
Manassas was the Battle of Bull Run.
Correct, yes. Yeah, you're using the old terms.
Right.
Yes, yeah.
One of the stories you tell, and I guess it was Gardner, in filming one of the battles, actually staged his shot.
Yes. I often refer to Brady and Gardner as the first citizen journalists, and we talk about this all the time with Ferguson and all the other events now where people can go out into the street and actually shoot their own pictures and become a journalist and tweet that and put that on Facebook, and they're actually documenting events as they happen. Gardner and Brady had no journalistic training, really. Gardner was a newspaper editor, but didn't view his work in that way with photography. He viewed it much more as a science. But when they went out and did that, it was something entirely different.
And can anyone here imagine finding a body in a trench and saying, "Nah, it doesn't look right. We got to fix this up a little bit," and literally moving the body?
They literally were the first movie creators because Alexander Gardner on the battlefield went out and actually moved a soldier several yards to set up the best looking shot that could ever possibly be taken. If you can imagine in the heat lugging a body, which he needed several of his operators to help him do, and place his rifle in the right hand and to do all of the right things, it was quite an amazing feat, but also a warning about the picture doesn't always tell the true story of what happened.
Imagine a journalist doing that today. I mean, would be severely reprimanded if not fired.
They would be getting ready for the electric chair.
I have to take a break. We'll do that. We'll take a very brief break and be back in just a moment. We're talking with Nick Pfister, and we're talking about his book, Shooting Lincoln. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. We are back. Nick, what other battles were either of them involved in that were of note during the war?
Well, Gardner was certainly involved in many more of them than Brady. When they broke away after the Battle of Antietam, Gardner had gotten very upset that he had gone out to Antietam and done the hard work of taking all of those great shots that Brady had put up in his studio and branded them under his own name, and that it got all of this media attention throughout the country. So Gardner left the studio, created his own. And in the years that followed, Gardner was at many more of those battles. Brady would send his own operators out to those things. They met once again in Gettysburg. Gardner had gotten there first. Brady always got there late. Brady did visit Gettysburg. And at that point, Brady had created his own other, the showman being what he was, started doing what we would see Alfred Hitchcock do almost 100 years later, is actually appear in the photos. Brady would appear off to the side of the photos that they would take of the battlefield, almost like a narrator of the photo that they were doing. And Gardner would take much more different shots.
During the course of this period, they were also taking photographs of President Lincoln.
Yes. Brady actually took the first famous photo of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. Lincoln had gone to New York City, and it was really the making of Abraham Lincoln. It was a snowy day. Lincoln had showed up. There was all this press attention around this sort of rural Illinoisan, and being from Illinois, I identify with that and how people view that. But he showed up there, and there was all this attention around how he looked. He was very tall. He looked gangly. They liked to describe his features in very negative tones. There were a lot of political cartoons that had just come up. Illustrations were a new thing in magazines and in woodcuts that had just started. And they would all characterize Lincoln in very negative tones. Lincoln arrived there, and the first place he went to was Matthew Brady's studio. Mm-hmm. On his walk there, he bought a top hat, which became one of his icons. Lincoln ended up taking a shot with Brady. Brady posed him in a unique way, made him stand up still, and showed his height, actually, which was new for the time. And a year later, when Lincoln was elected president, he was at the White House, and someone introduced him to Matthew Brady, and Lincoln said, "No, I already know him. He's the man who made me president."
Throughout, a very haggard look on President Lincoln. Unlike some of the portrayals we see today, he really looked drawn out.
He used that to his advantage. People ended up identifying with that. He was in many ways the first populist president, when we talk about that in those terms, other than Andrew Jackson maybe. But he used that image of himself, and Harper's Magazine actually used the image that Brady had taken on their cover with buffaloes roaming in the background, and it made him look like this man of the people, this unique person, this unique figure. And that really was the beginning of the image that we all have of Lincoln and the story of Lincoln that we have in our own lives about what he was, the hardscrabble man who came up from nothing, who became a country lawyer, and ultimately the president. And that moment, I think, really was the beginning of modern political propaganda and modern political media.
So Honest Abe is the one who got all that started, huh?
He did, and he used it well to his benefit. If you go to the Abraham Lincoln Library in Springfield, you see these cartoons of him, and they would showcase his big ears or his long face or his dirty clothes or something like that. What the political cartoonists didn't actually realize is they were doing him a favor. It made people identify him more with the people, and we ended up seeing that years later in this most recent election with Donald Trump. The more the media attacked him, the more he fed off of that. And so in many ways, as Harry Truman said, there's nothing new in the world other than the history you don't know.
Another picture that I think many people have seen along the way is the one with the President Lincoln and his son. Was it Todd, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Ted.
Ted, yeah. That picture is seen a lot by folks.
Yes, and that was also taken by Brady, and that both Brady and Gardner had taken many photos of Lincoln through their lives, and they were battling to be the exclusive photographers of Lincoln, and it would kind of go back and forth throughout his presidency. But Brady did have an eye for adding people into the scene that Gardner did not. And Brady had Tad and would shoot him with Lincoln reading a book to his son, and it became this sort of Lincoln as the father image, and we still have that today, and that's in the book. And Gardner saw that and hated that Brady was able to do that, and before Lincoln died was attempting to recreate that scene, but it never looked the same.
Lincoln did die, of course, assassinated in April of 65, and I guess this is really where you're putting most of your emphasis on the book, in terms of the scramble to get the picture that would be the picture of all of that, and then what happened afterwards. Why don't you pick it up with the assassination and what these photographers wanted to make of it?
Well, I will actually start a few months right before the assassination. Sure. Alexander Gardner had taken more photos of Abraham Lincoln than any person alive, and he had gotten Lincoln to come to his studio in February, which is a few months before the assassination. And that actually became the last studio portrait that Lincoln ever sat for. And he went there, and you could see in that last photo the history of the war on his face. They often said that he looked like he had already died. And you can see what was coming almost. And as Lincoln went to his studio, John Wilkes Booth was in the background planning an assassination against Lincoln. They had actually been planning on kidnapping him when Lincoln would go throughout the city of Washington during this time. They knew the war was ending. They were unhappy about it. He had developed relationships with all of these conspirators. They were monitoring his movements. Lincoln arrived at his studio that day, sat for the photo. He looked terrible and did not care. The war was close to ending, but he had on his mind how to improve the nation in the wake of that. Gardner took the last photo of him. Later that night, while he was making the photo, a glass plate broke. A line went straight through the top of Lincoln's forehead, which matched the trajectory of the bullet that would go through his forehead several months later.
Boy, oh boy, that's really kind of scary, isn't it?
Yes.
Wasn't there another occasion where John Wilkes Booth showed up in a picture? I think, didn't you put in the inauguration?
Yes.
Of Lincoln?
Alexander Gardner had actually, in March, so several months right after that, Alexander Gardner was there for the inauguration of President Lincoln, for his second inauguration, and had taken a photo of Lincoln speaking to a large group of people on the Capitol steps. John Wilkes Booth was up in the background peering over Lincoln. He had said that he could have killed the president that day, but decided he didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. So that appeared, and Gardner had also taken a photo of Booth, who was a very famous celebrity. People don't remember that sometimes, but John Wilkes Booth was perhaps one of the most famous men other than Lincoln in the country at the time.
A dashing young actor that people highly respected.
Yes, he was Tom Cruise of that time period, or whoever is popular now.
Yeah. Well, he made good on his intention to murder the president. And then, again, the photographers wanted to scramble to get the picture.
Yeah, and so in that moment, Brady and Gardner were locked into a heated battle trying to get the epic shots of the aftermath of the Civil War. Brady, who was always late to the scene, which I had mentioned later, actually was in Virginia when Lincoln was shot and killed. But he was trying to get, which he did get, was a famous photo of Robert E. Lee. Lee had surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox Courthouse just days earlier. No one was able to get that picture. But what they had battled to do in that period was to get the picture of Lee on his own. And Brady was able to do that. While Brady was preparing to take that picture, Lincoln was shot and killed. Brady learned the news, was very disappointed. He was not in Washington that time, and rushed up to Washington, D.C. to work with his operators to get on to the chase for the conspirators who had conspired to kill the president.
Well, there was also a period where they wanted to get the scene. Again, they had to stage some things, did they not, to get the scene of the assassination?
They did. The photographers cooperated with the government back then, which was very common. They were allowed into Ford's Theater, went in there, and in fact, what Gardner did, as he did with the dead body in Antietam and moving it, Lincoln had the presidential box in Ford's Theater, which they had the presidential bunting and all that around there, which had been removed in the wake of the assassination. He actually had them come and recreate that, and he shot that as it was recreated.
And, of course, that's all people ever got to see of that event.
Yes.
Although there was an autopsy.
There was an autopsy of President Lincoln, which was not shot by any photographer.
But they wanted it.
They wanted it, and they were not allowed. And there was a big battle between Gardner and Brady to get a photo of Lincoln in death. Neither of them were able to do that. One of their rivals actually got a photo of Lincoln in his casket in New York when he was lying in state. And Brady had such power with the federal government that he complained to the Secretary of War, who swooped in and demanded the photo be destroyed. What they ended up doing was confiscating the photo, taking it to the Secretary of War's personal archives. It was put into a vault. It was never seen again for about another 100 years until it was found in the archives of the Lincoln Library in Springfield and is now on display there.
There was some suggestion in your book, as I recall it, and it's been about a month since I finished it, that maybe one of the doctors or maybe someone presiding at the autopsy had gotten a picture and squirreled it away someplace, never to be seen?
Well, Lincoln's photo was seen. There's another autopsy that has not been seen, and I think people are still trying to find a picture of that today, which is of John Wilkes Booth. After he had been killed by the Union cavalry, he was brought aboard the prisoner ships that they had in Washington, and they brought Gardner in to take a picture of that scene. And Gardner allegedly took that photo. It was taken by the Secretary of War into custody, and it hasn't been seen. But his son later said that that picture actually was never taken. And so there's been this hunt for this photo for more than 150 years, and it's never been found.
Well, let's talk for a moment, speaking of hunts, of the hunt for John Wilkes Booth. Most people, I think, when they look back on that part of history, think only of John Wilkes Booth. He was the actual assassin. We'll talk about the others who were involved a little bit later, but Booth jumped out of the box and onto the stage and hurt his leg, broke his leg, whatever it was, and took off. And the search for him was pretty remarkable.
Yes. I mean, that set off a worldwide frenzy. If you think about if we had a presidential assassination today, or if you think about the Kennedy assassination, what that was like, Washington became the epicenter of an international story at that point. Lincoln became a martyr in that. People often only identify Booth with that shooting, but he had been working with a large group of conspirators in an attempt to take the president's life, but not only his life, but to also take the life and to cripple the government in other ways. That night, they were also to kill the vice president and the secretary of state. One of Booth's accomplices was a man named Lewis Powell, sometimes Lewis Payne. He's photographed in this book, and he looks almost like a movie star in the book. But he did enter the secretary of state's house that evening when Lincoln was killed, was able to get into his bedroom and stabbed him dozens of times, nearly killed him, was able to escape. Another man named George Atzerodt was supposed to kill the vice president, Andrew Johnson, but he ended up just getting drunk at the hotel bar that night.
And the Secretary of State at that time was Mr. Seward, who bought Alaska for us.
He bought Alaska, yes, so we always remember him for that.
And just a little bit more about the chase for John Wilkes Booth and how they found him.
Yeah, so Wilkes Booth had escaped into the woods of Maryland and south of Washington, D.C. There was this big hunt to find him. It took them almost a dozen days to find him, and had an accomplice with him who knew the territory. He actually survived in the swamplands south of Washington for a long time. Finally, they had put these reward posters out, which Alexander Gardner helped make. He actually was with the Secret Service. He made the first real wanted posters that we have today, and it was of the conspirators, and they put them up all over the country. There was a massive reward to lead to finding them. Finally, someone came forward and said, I think they're, you know, down the road here. And they believed it to be true, and they went and found them. But as media works, there were all sorts of sightings throughout the country of John Wilkes Booth, including one in St. Louis, including one in Philadelphia. None of them were true.
How did they identify the conspirators?
With photos. All of the conspirators had...
Before the photos, how did they know that there were these other people involved?
Well, they had gone and investigated who John Wilkes Booth had been associated with in the run-up to the killings, and it all went around this boarding house in Washington, D.C. that was owned by a woman named Mary Surratt, who subsequently became the first woman ever executed by the federal government.
She was certainly one of the conspirators.
Her son was friends with John Wilkes Booth, and many of the other people who had lived at that place were friends with John Wilkes Booth, and it all became centering around them. And the photos that Brady and Gardner had taken of all of those people prior to the assassination were put on wanted posters and all over the country.
And once they were captured, more photographs were taken, and they're in your book. But you point out that Gardner did the shooting and that these were really the first mugshots of the style that we know today, front
yes.
and side.
In fact, it became what we call a rogues gallery, and Alexander Gardner, years later with the New York Metropolitan Police, or the Washington Metropolitan Police Department, created what became the first shots of a prisoner looking straight ahead and then off to the side, which is what they did with the conspirators that are in this book. And he did these big, long photo shoots of all of them and documented all of their facial details and their body details. And you could see them cuffed and manacled in that.
He got to know them a little bit, and as I recall, even like a couple of them.
Yes, he actually really liked Louis Powell, who's the man who stabbed the Secretary of State, you know, dozens of times. Yes. He identified with some things about him, just like in journalism, as you know, Don, as you get to know people that you're interviewing, mm-hmm. and sometimes you might become sympathetic to them, or sometimes you might learn more about where they're coming from, not necessarily as much as in this case, but he did identify with a lot of his subjects, including Mary Surratt, who he did not actually take a mugshot of, but he knew her. And when she was ultimately killed, that was a very painstaking moment for him.
The most chilling part of your book, in spite of the fact we've talked about the Great War with hundreds of thousands of people killed in the assassination of a president, to me the most chilling part was the part that follows, the lead up to the execution and the photographing of the execution.
Yeah.
Just extraordinary.
Yeah, and that is the moment that I argue created modern media as we know it. I talked about the battlefield photography that they'd taken because they could only take photos of things that were in stillness. But what happened with the conspirators after they had been tried and sentenced to be killed, that Alexander Gardner had decided to set up a multi-camera shoot so he could shoot the hanging of the conspirators in sequence. And so he had several operators with him, and it was the first time you could really see a live news event unfold as it happened. And he ended up getting more than 10 pictures, and if you pick them up today and look at them in sequence, you see the bodies drop to their deaths. And that's the first time they could go to his gallery, because when the conspirators were killed, there was this rush of mob of people attempting to get to the grounds of the Washington Arsenal to see what was happening at this event, and no one could really get in. It was the hottest ticket in town. So Gardner ended up being able to display those in his studio where people could actually go there and see the event live, almost like they could many years later on television.
And everybody wanted to have it verified that these people were, in fact, executed.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, I just want to use a quote here I was looking from you from the book. You said, "Modern news media was born on the day the Lincoln conspirators were executed."
Correct. And what we have today really traces everything back to that one moment on July 7th, 1865.
Got to take another break. We'll do that now. We're talking with Nick Pister. He's the author of Shooting Lincoln. We're talking about the book, and we're doing it at Left Bank Books. And we have an audience, and we'd like the audience to ask some questions when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we're back with Nick Pister, the author of Shooting Lincoln. Nick, I wanted to ask you about something that I had seen in the book. I was sure I had. In my notes, I just wrote down Private Eye. And it, as I recalled it, the term Private Eye came out of this era.
Yes, it did. Actually, Alan Pinkerton was a member of the union, and he became the first real detective of this country and created his own detective studio. Alexander Gardner worked with him and was a spy for the Union government in the war. Gardner actually was the first person to make counterfeit money. He would actually photograph money and reprint it, and he worked with the Secret Service to show them how you could create your own banknotes, and it created a big issue. Pinkerton, though, had his own agency, and that's when the first detective agency really occurred.
And ultimately, it didn't, but the Secret Service kind of came out of that whole—
Yes, that was the beginning period of everything right there.
Yeah. Back to the executions. The executions weren't easy. They were all hanged at the same time, but it was not an easy day getting that job done, was it?
No, it was about 100 degrees outside, and Gardner was attempting to do this thing that was monumental in American history, and it was very difficult to take photographs in the heat like that because they used chemicals on the glass plates, and it brought in all kinds of bugs and maggots and things like that, and if there was any wind, it would create an issue. And so just the preparations for that were enormous, and it was a surreal experience for him that he would document later, is that preparing to know that people who he knew were going to die was something very new. It was much different than on the battlefield, where you would go out there and take these images after everything had happened, but knowing that this was going to happen at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and hopefully that he would be able to take those photographs. He didn't know if he would be able to do it. He ultimately was able to do it. But the preparations for that occurred for days and days and days for him to prepare. And that not only occurred for just the physical preparations for it, but it was also his relationships with the United States government. And he was the only photographer allowed into this facility, is because he had a really good relationship with the man who was in charge of the facility, and they allowed him to be the only person in. Matthew Brady was not allowed in, and that gave Gardner an exclusive.
Brady must have really loved that.
Yes.
Yeah. Gardner had a ringside seat, but it was not a close-up seat.
No. It was up on a perch above the platform that had been created to hang the conspirators. He had shot it almost looking straight at them or down, but it was not right there in their face.
Even so, it's chilling to watch people go to their death, even if it's still photography. The way he shot it, as you described, very hard to even look at.
Yes, and in the book you can read about how the people involved in the actual execution experienced it. They had gotten many members of the union to come and be volunteers to be part of it. They needed men to push the posts from underneath the scaffolds so they would drop to their deaths. One man was throwing up very badly in the minutes up to the execution because it was so hot outside, and they weren't really prepared for this. Also, right up to the very last minute, they thought that Mary Surratt might have her sentence commuted, she being the first woman to be executed. They had posted people all down the line of Pennsylvania Avenue and all the way down to the Washington Arsenal to be prepared to receive a notice from the president that her sentence would be commuted. That never came, and she ultimately was executed.
She got a little special treatment, did she not?
Yes, all of the jail guards liked her, and they felt sorry for her. One of the reasons why she was executed was because of her son had associated with John Wilkes Booth. But another reason was because in her house she had kept a photo of some of the Confederate generals that her daughter had purchased, actually from Alexander Gardner's studio. And that's one way they would identify someone's allegiances back then, was if they had photos. They were almost like trading cards that people would buy. And if you had a photo of Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee in your house, that would certainly mean that you were sympathetic to the Confederate cause, or if you had a photo of Lincoln or Sherman or someone like that.
Were they all tried at the same time?
Yes, they were all tried at the same time. There were many more people than the four who were executed that were tried at the same time. And many had said that the trial was a rush to judgment.
One-day trial.
Well, it occurred more than one day, but it happened very quickly right after they were all rounded up. The assassination occurred in April of 1865. The four conspirators were killed by July 7th of 1865. If you think in modern terms of how long a trial takes, that is quite speedy.
Tell us something, Nick, about the research.
Yes.
Obviously, there was an awful lot that had to go into that, and you're going back 100-plus years, well over 150 years. How do you get the kind of information that you managed to dig up?
Well, we talked about my first book, which took me about 10 years to actually publish. This is much different. That book, all the archives and everything was in German, and it took many years to get that translated and go through that entire process. This book was a lot different, and I learned from that previous experience that you can't spend all your time researching news articles and things like that that had happened. What you really have to do is start writing, because when you start writing, you learn what you don't know, like what the temperature was on a certain day or what else was going on. In the Battle of Antietam, I write about what it sounded like when they were actually photographing the dead bodies. You could hear them using machetes to cut the corn so they could get through the fields to find other dead bodies. It was a very bizarre experience for those men to be taking the photographs in that environment, but also the sounds you would hear of people screaming for help, or the sights that they would see. Many times they would put piles of amputated limbs. They would just be like, they're like cordwood that they would be walking by. It was a harrowing experience, and something that was burned into their minds for the rest of their lives, as for the soldiers as well that experienced it.
I meant to point out that the pictures of the executions that we were talking about are in the book, along with many others. You'll be able to see exactly what Nick is talking about in the book. And we have a question.
Hello.
Could you give us your name, please?
Laura
Staley.
Are there photographs of President Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address? I don't think I've ever seen one.
Yes, there is. Not taken by any of the two in my book, but there's a shadowy photo of Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address. Mm-hmm. Actually, shortly before he died, he had gone to Gettysburg for a memorial of his famous address, and both Brady and Gardner were up there in attendance for a dedication of a monument there.
Yes, sir. Come on up. Your name, please, and then your question or comment.
Michael Mullins from Webster Groves. You could see Brady and Gardner as the progenitors of either the classic war correspondence of World War II or Vietnam, Images of Life magazine and so forth, or you could see them as the progenitors of the paparazzi or TMZ, and you could see them either way. My question is, did you, in your research, contact any of the descendants of Gardner or Brady and get their perspective on the legacies of their forebears?
Mm-hmm, yes. Brady actually has many family members. They were actually nieces and nephews of his. He didn't have any children. It became the Levin family, and they created an archive which exists today at Yale University, which they gave over to Yale University. I've talked to them. One of his descendants is a documentary filmmaker. His mother had created one of the first popular children's books called Pat the Bunny. So there's a long history of Lincoln in that family from Brady that has gone down through his life. I think one of the things that's very sad in the book is what happened to Brady in his final years. He was one of the most famous men in this country. His name is on a photo in almost everyone's household. And after the war, all those photos that he had taken, no one had wanted them anymore. He had actually lost most of his money trying to send people out to cover the war. It was very expensive. He was not CNN. He didn't have big people behind him to give him lots of money other than his name. Ultimately, he lost almost everything after that because nobody wanted to look at those images until probably 30 years later. Shortly after he died, there became this big groundswell of interest in the Civil War. Once again, people wanted to go back and remember that. Brady died destitute. He had nothing other than a ring that was given to him by the King of England. And that's the only thing that he had on him.
Gardner much more innovative. How did he wind up after the war?
Gardner actually was much better with money, handled himself a lot better. Right after the war, went out west and became one of the first photographers to take pictures of the Great Plains and places out there, became the first person to take pictures of the Sioux Indians and bring them back to the Eastern audience. He was paid in whiskey. That was the type of work they were doing back then. I guess he learned, as some of us do in journalism, that it doesn't pay all that well. So he started an insurance business, got very involved in Freemasonry, died fairly wealthy, had a huge funeral. He was eulogized. There was articles in the paper right up to his death. He died much more well off than Matthew Brady. Brady, though, however, did live on much more in history. His name became much more famous. And if you remember, Brady's name and his studio and everything that he did became the fulcrum of what Ken Burns did in 1989 with the Civil War documentary. And we wouldn't have that if it weren't for Brady.
During your research, did you run into any copyright issues with these photographs?
No, luckily they all have outlived copyright law. You know, 150 years old goes a long way.
What surprised you in your research? Oh, we have another question. I'll take the question first. Your name,
please. My name is Linda Martin, and my question is, when you spoke of finding the conspirators in John Wilkes Booth in the southern part of Washington, was he not at a doctor's house, and then the doctor was thought to be a conspirator and then...
Yes.
Is that in your book?
Yes, that is in the book. When he had gone south from Washington, he had gone to a doctor named Samuel Mudd, who had actually set his leg. Mudd had said he did not know who John Wilkes Booth was. They showed him his picture that they had. He later then identified him. He was put on trial. He was convicted and later set free after serving some time.
With all of this research, as I started, do you have a question, sir?
Yes, sir.
Come on up and ask it.
I'm Hal Harris. I'm a retired professor at UMSL, as a matter of fact.
Ah, great.
And my question is about what use those Gardner photographs of the conspirators' execution was put to. I would think that whole execution in such a public setting was intended to send a message, and that message would be reinforced with the photographs that Gardner took. And I wonder if they were promulgated in newspapers and things like that.
Well, what actually happened is the government just wanted one photo to be able to say that it had happened. That's all that they wanted. Gardner had much more grand plans for it and did that big shoot where you can see much more of the sequence of events that happened. You can see them walking to the scaffold put up there. You can see them having the nooses fitted around their necks. You can see the Catholic priest going to Mary Surratt and pressing a crucifix to her lips if you blow it up really closely. You can see and almost feel the event happen live. That is not what the government wanted. That's not what he was supposed to do. That's what he did. It was later put in Harper's Weekly, which is where they put most of these photos back then. He sold them to them, and they put those in there, and that's when people really got to see the events unfold from there. However, you would really have to go visit his studio in that time to see the photographs in real, because then the newspapers and magazines could only run woodcuts, which didn't quite show the real reality of the photos. That didn't happen until many years later, where they could really reprint those.
What would they be paid for photographs like these? Do you have any idea?
Not a lot of money, not for the reprints. It would be something along the lines of what a freelancer would get now for selling a photo to a major newspaper. What they really made their money from was selling the photos of Lincoln on cardstock to people all throughout the country, or of Lee, and copywriting those images. They didn't really make a lot of money off of the pictures of the war itself, because nobody just went and bought a photo of the Battle of Antietam or the aftermath, because it was kind of a weird thing to have up in your house.
Sure. I started to ask you before, in all your research, is there something that really surprised you, that just kind of bowled you over, that you hadn't thought of before or heard of before?
Well, what really struck me is how close those events mimic what we have today, and how both of the two men really blazed the trail of media that we have now, and they were the first men to do it. Gardner, being a spy and everything that he did the counterfeiting and went on and had a great life. But what surprises you the most is how, when you talk about TMZ or you talk about paparazzi or you talk about even film, you can trace back everything to what they did right back there. It's Instagram, it's Twitter, it's Facebook, it's television, it's the newsreels that you would see before World War II. It is the Zapruder film of John F. Kennedy. It is all of that rolled into one, and it all traces right back then and there.
What is life like as a successful author?
It's fine. Everything's different every day.
But you can make your own schedule. That's nice.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's certainly nice not having to chase a deadline. At some moments, you do miss being involved in the breaking news nature of things when you see the stuff going on in St. Louis. I was in Ferguson for a long period of time, and you do miss being out there and in the action.
But, of course, you leave at a time when the newspaper world is so uncertain. I think the Trump presidency is helping newspapers, certainly in Washington. The Times in New York and the Washington Post are certainly taking full advantage of the stories that are breaking.
I actually think if you look at what's happened to the newspaper industry and the decline of it, but what it's becoming and what the news industry is becoming as a whole, you can look back in the time period of the Civil War and see a lot of similarities there. Newspapers were really begun as propaganda. They were partisan operations. They had a political bent to them, and you're seeing the media become much more polarized in both directions as far as it's going. The one unique thing is now you have candidates, particularly in the president, who's able to use his own medium through social media and go over the media, making them perhaps less relevant and certainly less mainstream as far as what you remember of CBS, of Walter Cronkite. That doesn't exist anymore.
No, sure it doesn't. Our time is winding down. I'll ask if there are any more questions from the audience. I have one more, and that is, you know, you spend a lot of time doing this research that you've done. And I often ask this question, did you like these guys? Were you fond of them in any way or grew to dislike them?
I like both of them. It's hard to write a book about somebody you don't like, and then that obviously turns out to be very badly. Yeah. I recognized many of their positive attributes. I identified with Brady's spirit to try to find and take the photos of the most famous people of the time and to be one of them, and also of Gardner's great optimism to try to push the medium forward and to push science forward, which is really what his goal was. So much of the positive American experience you can see rolled up into both of them, just in different ways and in different shades.
You know, you mentioned that Brady died destitute, but he wasn't selling anything. He wasn't successful any longer. Do you think it would be fair to say that in any sense that he was broken by Gardner's success?
I think so. In one of the last chapters, it is called Broken. It actually begins with him going to Saratoga Springs, which is where all the rich people would hang out. And Brady always stayed at the best hotels, and his studios were always lavishly furnished. And by the end of it, he was on a storefront above a small place in Washington, D.C., just trying to make it. And one of the last photos that's included in the book is his photos were actually crumbling, and they were put in corners, and there was water damage on all of them. And you could see how his life deteriorated very quickly right after the war. And he was never the same. He was hit by a car or hit by a buggy shortly before he passed away, and he was never able to regain anything other than he was trying to put on a massive photo exhibition in New York before he died, but he was not able to do it.
In a sense, I guess he was a victim of the war as well.
Yes, and it lived with him, and he talked about, years later, he would give interviews about that first Battle of Bull Run, and he said Americans will never know what it put him through to send all of those men out into battle and the great toll it took on his personal fortune to do that. And in some ways, we don't think of those men enough when we think about journalism and when we think about how we remember that war, which is the war that's most first remembered by people. He is the man and the reason why we know it.
Well, you did a great job on the book, a very readable book and wonderful history, wonderful job of research. Nick Pister, thank you.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate it.
Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU, Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.